This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
The Briefing Room. Open the auditory door, take a virtual chair, and spend 28 minutes being guided by the experts through a tricky question of the moment. Today, Britain has entered a new period of pandemic restrictions, but will Britons comply with them? Life is confusing right now for everyone.
In the northeast and other areas where extra tight measures have been brought in, you should follow the guidance of local authorities. But it's six in a home or six in hospitality, but as I understand it, not six outside.
Which was wrong. Boris Johnson later apologised for misspeaking. But there are now around a third of the people in the UK living under tighter restrictions. And with the added complexity comes an additional worry that a confused and tetchy population might withdraw its compliance. Is that worry justified? How well do we understand what's been asked of us to stop the spread of the coronavirus? And how compliant are we? Step into the briefing room and let's find out. To start, let's remind ourselves of what's happening in different parts of the UK right now. Dominic Casciani is the BBC's Home Affairs correspondent. Dominic, can you give us an idea about what's going on across the country in terms of restrictions?
Well, David, basically the situation now is so complicated. Each of the four nations are running their own rules in relation to restrictions on coronavirus. So, for instance, in England, a lot of people will be familiar with the rule of six, which means a maximum of six people from multiple households can meet up both indoors and outdoors. There are variations of that in the other nations. So in Scotland, it's slightly different because their version of the rule of six doesn't involve younger children. In Wales, the rules are slightly tougher, as they are in Northern Ireland as well. So you've got kind of got that as the kind of like the headline thing. And then each of the nations on top of that has various restrictions around, for instance, wearing face coverings, for instance, on public transport and shops. So that's the broad brush thing. Where it gets then a bit more complicated is around some of the interpretation of this. So, for instance, in England, we have a law now that says it's illegal to mingle. Yeah, that's quite a complicated thing for people to kind of get their heads around. What does mingling mean in practice? So there's a lot going on here, and it's been changing month after month.
In essence, if you were to move across the country, you'd have to consult some kind of almanac to discover where you were at any given time.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right, David. And to be frank, that almanac doesn't exist. I mean, back in March and April, I and colleagues were trying to keep our eye across the whole of the law in an attempt to produce for the public, largely on the website of the BBC, a comprehensive guide of what were the rules in each part of the UK. This task has become, in practical terms, impossible because things are changing so fast and the rules between the nations are just too difficult. And I've got to be honest, you know, we're speaking to people who are listening to Radio 4. I would say to people, you need to go and listen to your local radio station and read your local newspaper to really, really understand what's going on close to you, because national reporters just can't summarise this neatly enough because of the differences between the regions.
Now, I'll be talking later to some people who've been surveying compliance in the United Kingdom, but you've been doing your own work on this, haven't you? So what are the broad brush conclusions that you've come to on compliance?
Well, I mean, anecdotally, everyone thinks rates of compliance are fairly high. And now we wanted to look very specifically at how people were responding to requirements such as to go into self-isolation after coming back from holiday. We thought this was particularly important given we were at the end of the holiday season. People who may have delayed holidays, maybe dashing off for that last bit of summer sun somewhere around Europe. Ipsos Mori, the survey company, looks into this for us. We asked people, what they would do on their return. Now, the vast majority said if they were required to by the law, they would self-isolate if returning from a hotspot, or if, for instance, they tested positive, or separately, if they were told by NHS Track and Trace that they'd been in close proximity to someone who had tested positive. Now, when we started looking more closely into this data, we asked people what they thought was an acceptable reason to break the law. 20% said it was acceptable to break the law to go to work. 25% said it was acceptable to break the law to care for someone. And this tallies with wider and deeper studies which are emerging, a real disconnect there between what people are saying are their intentions and actually perhaps what they're doing in practice.
Dominic Casciani, and we'll come back to you later, Dominic. Daisy Fancourt, Associate Professor of Psychobiology and Epidemiology at University College London, helped establish the COVID Minds Network to look at the impact coronavirus has had on our well-being. This has involved surveying how people have been behaving under restriction. Professor Fancourt, how many people are taking part in your study?
We've got over 70,000 people taking part, and it's a weekly survey. So people have been contributing data since just before lockdown came in. So in total now, we've had over 750,000 surveys. And what it's allowed us is in real time, just like we're tracking cases and deaths, to actually be able to track people's behaviours and attitudes.
Now, if we cast our minds back to the start of the pandemic as lockdown approached, what could you say about public attitudes to the restrictions which were about to be put in place?
Well, what we actually saw was that people got very anxious and stressed in the lead up to lockdown coming in, and people actually responded very well to the government coming in with clear rules, a very strong lockdown at the end of March. And we actually saw that trust in the government to handle the pandemic went up following that. And we had very high levels of self-reported compliance with that incredibly high, way into the 90%. So it seemed like people were really happy to follow what they were being told.
But does that diminish over time?
Well, we have actually seen a decrease in compliance since, but I don't think it's been driven by a fatigue. We've particularly seen a decrease since the lockdown rules started to be eased, and that appears to have been driven by a few factors. One of them is that we've seen that people have got very confused about what the rules are. So during strict lockdown, over 90% of people in the UK were saying they understood what they were supposed to be doing. Whereas once the rules started to ease, it was down to only 45% in England who actually reported thinking they understood the rules. I mean, we're still seeing that the vast majority of people are complying. But I think what we've seen in particular is when people don't comply, it's been much more of a bending of the rules rather than a breaking of the rules.
So is it more that it's not that people don't want to follow some kind of rules, but that they have been tailoring the rules a little bit more to suit themselves and suit their circumstances while trying to have what they thought was the same effect as the rules?
Exactly. And I think that's kind of been a natural consequence of the last few months because, A, the rules have got a lot more complex. It's supposed to just stay at home. But also people's lives are now much more complex. They're going back to work or school or whatever. So they've got to apply the rules to a much bigger range of scenarios. But also the messaging from the government has subtly shifted as well, which has sort of enabled people to make these changes. Like we saw in the press conference last night, Boris Johnson was asking people to use common sense and follow the basics of the guidance. And that's not at all what I think many of us thought we were supposed to be doing. We were thinking we were supposed to fully follow the rules. So these subtle changes in language have almost given permission for people to start making modifications.
Now, this week, the government published a study, quite dramatic, actually, because it found just 18% of people who had symptoms went into isolation, which you'd have thought was the most obvious thing, rule to try and follow. How does that tally with your research?
Well, I think what's interesting is if we look at that specific study, they actually found that between 70 and 80% of people intended to go into isolation, but then we were only seeing this much smaller number that actually did. And what this really suggests is that there's not necessarily a motivational problem. People are happy with the idea of going into isolation. But what this study found, which has been very much borne out by our own study as well, is that people are facing barriers to going into isolation. And some of these are around understanding. So not really understanding the rules, some people thinking that if they feel better when they've had COVID, that they're then allowed to go out because they've recovered. But it's also logistical problems. So people who are facing financial constraints or caring responsibilities, or people who need to go to the pharmacy or shops or have other medical appointments. These are the reasons that are being cited as the main explanation of this difference between intentions and behaviours.
How would you break down the categories of people who don't observe or find themselves breaking the guidelines?
Well, one of the biggest factors that's predicted compliance has been age. So younger adults have been less likely to completely follow the guidance compared to older adults. Now, this sort of makes sense on a certain level in that younger adults' lives have been more complex. You know, they're the ones who have been asked to go back to university. Many young people are key workers. So these are situations where, again, you might be facing these sort of challenges about how to apply those rules. But I think at the same time, another interesting pattern that we've seen is that some of the people who are more likely to break the rules have been people with more financial resources. So there's been this sort of privilege aspect here, where I think we're seeing some people who feel that maybe they don't need to bother following the rules as much, and that they've almost got a right to make modifications. There is a different rule for everyone else compared to for them. And I think that's a dangerous one to be setting up when we're trying to get very high levels of compliance.
What about people who are in real economic difficulty if they do obey the rules more strictly?
This has been something that's been raised from a lot of people, particularly now in the north of England, where we've seen more restrictions. People saying that actually for them, what they're facing is a choice between following the rules and staying at home, but also potentially losing their job in the process. And I think we've heard, for example, fines being brought in to try and disincentivize people from breaking the rules. But that's sort of taking slightly the wrong approach, because those fines might work for the very small number of people who are having house parties or raves, but they're not really going to help with the people who are facing financial problems. For them, it's not a motivational issue where a fine is going to put them off. It's a financial logistical barrier that they need support to overcome rather than punishments.
Interesting. Now, one of the things that you've been doing in your survey is tracking people's mental health throughout the pandemic. Has that got any correlation with people's willingness or ability to comply?
It was something where initially we were really interested in this, because we were actually hypothesizing that it might be related. But we've just completed a study where we've been looking at a wide range of factors that could predict compliance. And there is only one very clear predictor of compliance, and that's people's trust in the government to handle the pandemic well, that they believe that the rules that are being set for them are the right rules and are being set in an informed way.
Now, how has that changed?
We saw across all four nations that after lockdown came in, there was this boost in confidence in governments to handle this pandemic well. But what we've seen since, particularly in England, there's been quite a marked drop off in that confidence in governments. And that seems to have followed on from two events, one of which was the earlier easing of lockdown in England, but not in other nations. I think people in England worried it was too early. But then we've also seen that the confidence has dropped following the Dominic Cummings events, and it's not recovered in England. So that gap between England versus Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland has really widened in the last few months.
OK, so 6 months on from the beginning of the first lockdown, how would you characterise how we're doing? Are we still generally compliant?
I'd say that overall, we are still generally compliant. And it's really important that we're getting that message out so that people realise they're not the minority if they're following the rules. I think we're seeing more bending of the rules. And I think people often will think that this might be safe, but actually in reality, it might not be, because understanding how this virus transmits is very complicated. So I think there's still a message for people about playing it more cautious, even if you don't think that you yourself are a risk.
During the period you've been conducting the survey, has there been anything or any moment when you've looked at the results and thought, goodness gracious, I never expected to see that?
Something that's concerned us in the last few weeks is we've been looking at people's beliefs about vaccines. And of course, this is going to be the whole new definition of compliance once we have a vaccine, is are people going to agree to have it? And we've actually seen that the levels of misinformation around vaccines are quite a bit higher than we'd thought they were. And I think this is very concerning, because people don't necessarily actually know the facts or the truth about it and are already receiving information, particularly through social media, that is completely untrue and incorrect. So I think there's a lot of work over the next few months to try and make sure that correct messaging around the safety of vaccines, how they're approved and what they do, starts to get out there, so that when we do have a vaccine, we're in a situation where we're not then only just starting to battle misinformation and fake news.
Professor Daisy Fancourt with at least one major warning for the future. For the time being, though, given how much more complicated guidance and restrictions have become since March, we are pretty compliant. But we thought it would be useful to see how we compare to elsewhere in Europe. France has followed a similar pattern to us. They locked down, opened up, and are now imposing new restrictions. How compliant have the French been? Professor Jocelyn Rode is a social psychologist at the EHESP French School of Public Health in Rennes. Professor Rhode, can you just take us through the basic rules that people in France have to follow to stop the spread of the virus?
Actually, at a national level, we only have very few rules, so it can be totally different from one city to the other. The principal measure that we have here is to wearing face masks in the indoor spaces. If you don't wear any mask in a train or in a train station or in a supermarket, you could have to pay 130 euros, it's about £100. If you do it again the next month, you'll have to pay until 2,000 euros. But as much as I know, the controls are not very frequent and the number of fines is not very high for the moment.
So most of the things which are actual restrictions, which are enforced restrictions, are local restrictions.
Exactly. At the moment, the most affected cities are the big cities like Paris, Bordeaux, or Marseille, where the most striking rule is the fact that now most bar and restaurant have to close from 10 p.m. The other rules is we can't gather people for more than 10 in the public spaces.
Are there any restrictions about numbers of people meeting in houses?
No, for the moment we don't have a restriction for the private spaces.
What rule exists for people who have been tested positive for the virus?
At the beginning, the government asked people to stay at home for 2 weeks. Lately, it has been decided to reduce this duration to 1 week for several reasons. The first reason is a question of social acceptability, because they were afraid that people won't comply with these rules if it's too costly for them. And the second reason is a lot of scientists said it was not necessarily useful to have such a long duration of isolation, and 1 week will be probably enough.
Now let's talk about what you've noticed in terms of compliance with actual restrictions and also with recommendations. What has really struck you about how French people have adapted to those in the last 6 months?
Well, as you know, France have a very individualistic culture, so her policymakers were relatively concerned about the fact that the French may not accept the restriction due to the lockdown situation. But we have been extremely surprised to find that actually, there was a massive adherence of the French population to the recommendation. And what we found specifically is that about 95% of the French followed relatively strictly the rules that they have to follow. What we have observed is the fact that from June, while the epidemic was slowing down in France, there was a progressive and slightly decreasing in the adherence to recommendation and compliance to rules. But during the last week, while the epidemic is coming back, we have regular increasing of the level of compliance.
Has the level of compliance had anything to do with who has been delivering the message?
What we observe, especially concerning the mask, is it was even discouraged by the government, for example. But most of the French actually didn't follow the government recommendation. And as soon as they can get some masks, they massively use them. And what we observe is a continual increasing in the adoption of the mask in the French society. And now, in the last survey, what we can observe is the fact that 98% of the French population is using masks. And actually, it's a huge surprise for both the policymaker and the public health experts.
Did it make a difference whether politicians delivered the health message or whether health practitioners delivered the message?
The level of trust in France is one of the lowest in the Western world. So politicians have a real challenge, which is to deliver a message that can be accepted by the population. So quickly, what we observed during the first week of the pandemic is the fact that the politicians use more and more the scientists, and they established scientific council. And this council had a very important role during the first phase of the crisis.
Professor Jocelyn Rhode. Back in the UK, as we heard earlier, public understanding of the measures being taken has fallen quite significantly since lockdown was first introduced. But if we're really to expect people to comply, it's better if they know what's expected of them. This places a great burden on the government's public health messaging around COVID. How well has that messaging gone so far? Professor Linda Bald is a behavioural scientist at the University of Edinburgh. Linda, can we say that there is a blueprint for effective public health messaging?
Well, there's certainly a lot of evidence from good quality studies about how you communicate with the public on public health issues. And so I guess there's a number of different components. The first one is that it's better to keep messages simple and they should be consistent. They need to be trusted. They need to be evidence-based. And you need to explain why something is happening and why it's needed. So some explanation. It also needs to be frequent. Sorry, two more quick points. Frequent messaging, not just a one-off, and admit uncertainty where there is some. So we're not sure how long this is going to last, or we're not sure what the impact of this will be on particular groups. Those are kind of uncertainty statements, and the public respond well to honesty.
So what's been done well and what not so well?
So some of the things that have been done well is that the government has tried at various junctures to have simple messaging. You know, stay home, it was to save lives and to protect the NHS. Everybody understood that clear messaging. We then got later in the pandemic, stay alert was not something that really even the behavioural scientists knew what that meant. But now we have the rule of six, which even though when you dig into it, there are complexities, the message is simple. And again, the behavioural scientists have welcome that. So there has been some clearer messaging. That's gone well. But where things have gone wrong is the other elements I pointed to. Frequency of messaging, explaining clearly why something is happening, and admitting uncertainty. Those things have not been done well. So just frequency of messaging, things like the daily briefings have been paused. I don't think the government's given enough resource or ownership to different bodies that can speak to their communities and let them get on with it to mirror that public health messaging. And I also don't think they've been able to admit when they don't know what's going on or what to do, or even give enough of an explanation for some of the changes in the rules or guidance. They haven't said clearly to the public why this applies and what the evidence for it is.
Now, when you talk about allowing, if you like, the stage to other groups, what do you mean by that? Do you mean that the government should have encouraged, let's say, local authority press conferences or brought senior local authority people to the daily briefings, that kind of thing?
Absolutely. So I think that you need multiple voices speaking to multiple audiences with a similar message. So that means, yes, having others fronting press briefings, but crucially, the point you make, David, of involving local government. Local government, who, let's remind ourselves, in England, have responsibility for public health, and then harnessing, you know, youth organizations who speak to young people through social media. I don't think that the government, perhaps because they didn't have time, thought carefully enough about what is their communication campaign in the middle of a crisis.
I mean, I sense from what you're saying that you think that actually devolved government is a strength in many ways in getting messages over to particular sections of the population. But it has meant that there are different things happening in different places.
Yes, and I think that has definitely added to the complexity. But because devolved nations have authority over health and public health, they've made their own decisions. But it means that the public have questioned why. Let's use a specific example. With the rule of six, why are children not included in that in Scotland and they are included in England? And why is it six people from potentially six different households in England, but two households in Scotland and elsewhere? The public then question, well, is this being science-led or are the government just making it up as they go along? And I think that is difficult for people to comprehend and also to follow in terms of guidance.
What's the biggest danger here?
So the biggest danger here, I think, is complacency. Often with public health messaging, there is a view that it's expensive because actually engaging in this communication takes time and effort and money. And that if you do it for a short time, people will get the message, they'll understand it, and they'll continue with that behavior. And that is just not the case at all. So you have to be consistent and you have to keep doing it, particularly actually during a crisis. So the first big danger is complacency. And the second one is division. So if you don't take people with you, and in fact, different voices might actually actively encourage division, then it just gives people an opportunity to be more confused and also to say, well, I'm not going to follow the guidance because I'm hearing different things from different key actors.
Linda Bald. Finally, some of this is going to end up on the plate of the UK police forces. In England this week, it was announced that the maximum fines for those who refuse to self-isolate will rise up to £10,000. And anyone who tests positive for COVID-19 or has been told they've been in contact with someone who has now has a legal duty to quarantine. The UK government is hoping devolved administrations will follow suit. But how is this new law going to be enforced? And how are the police thinking about COVID enforcement for the future? BBC Home Affairs correspondent Dominic Casciani is back with me. Dominic, at the beginning of lockdown, there were some quite crazy stories about how the police were interpreting bits of the lockdown. The use of drones was famous. And at that time, were the police operating under any kind of national level guidance on how they should behave?
No, not right at the beginning, David, quite simply because this was an unprecedented situation for the police to find themselves in, to effectively, you know, start to police something which the week before was entirely legal behaviour and everyone's God-given right to kind of roam the country free and just get on with their lives. So we know there have been about 19,000 penalty notices given to people for breaking restrictions over the course of the pandemic so far. They will be for things like gatherings which are too large in someone's back garden or refusing to put a face covering on the train. But the interesting thing, David, is only half of those penalties have actually been paid so far by the people who received them. So we've got an awful lot of cases here where the police and potentially the Crown Prosecution Service are going to have to decide what they're going to do. And if they decide that they're going to pursue these, you're going to end up having to take an awful lot of people to court.
Can you explain what, if you like, the principles are that they've been operating under?
The basic underlying principle of British policing is the phrase, we police by consent. And what that means is they are not an arm of the military. They are drawn from the community. They live in the community. And therefore, they can only do their job and use their exceptional powers of arrest and investigation with the consent of the public. How that's been codified during the pandemic has come down to something which the police call the four E's. Now, the four E's are engage, explain, encourage and enforce as a last resort. I think the problem for the police and the challenge they're facing is they're trying to walk a very, very delicate line between keeping the public on side and not becoming the enemy in the middle of a very difficult situation.
So we've heard quite a lot of talk in the last couple of weeks about the new larger fines which can be levied for various forms of breaking the regulations and so on. Is that seen by the police as something that will happen in such a small number of cases that it's manageable, or as a threat to their ability to do policing in the way they'd like?
I think fundamentally this is a question of actually how they're going to manage the resources they've got. So just because the fines are going up, it doesn't necessarily mean in practical policing terms that chief constables are regarding this as a greater priority. But we have had a change of tone, and this change of tone came in last week ahead of the introduction of the higher fine. So, for instance, the £1,000 fine for breaking isolation after being told to by NHS Track and Trace. Martin Hewitt, he's one of the country's most senior police officers. He said very explicitly last week that the police have been playing their part in supporting the public to navigate these very difficult measures. But he then added the time for encouraging those who knowingly flout the rules is basically over. Now, that was an indication that the police are going to go in a little bit harder and faster. So I suspect what we'll see in the month ahead is greater focus on the things which they feel need breaking up. So where you've got evidence of a big party going on, I wonder whether those are the things that the police are going to target first, rather than going around literally patrolling the streets, making sure everybody's got their face covering on as they go into shops.
Dominic Casciani. My conclusion, at the outset, we were surprisingly compliant. And for all the horror stories, we remain compliant. The essential ingredient in all this, however, remains trust. Whatever bolsters that is to be welcomed. Whatever damages it is to be avoided. Thank you to my guests, Dominic Casciani, Daisy Fancourt, Jocelyn Rode and Linda Bald. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. It was produced by Richard Fenton-Smith, Bob Howard and Kirstine Knight. Our studio manager is Rod Farker and the editor is Jasper Corbett. If you enjoyed this podcast and are new to The Briefing Room, then do take a look through our archive. We've taken a really deep dive into the coronavirus pandemic in this year. A few weeks ago, we asked what we've learned about COVID-19 since it first emerged, and there were some quite surprising revelations. And with the US election looming, we've been exploring concerns about postal voting and so-called voter suppression to find out if this year's election will be free and fair. You can find these episodes and much, much more on the BBC Sounds app.
Hold up. if there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.